In our last lecture, I quoted one of Lewis's favorite passages from MacDonald. I am sometimes almost terrified at the scope of the demand made upon me, at the perfection of the self-abandonment required of me. Yet, outside of such absoluteness can be no salvation. End quote. The sentiment is moving and powerful and challenging, but above all, the word terrified is a striking word to be employed to describe the process of yielding to the love of God. Nevertheless, this aspect of fear and terror and awe points to a deep theme in Lewis, the idea of the numinous. In other words, it's not just difficult to let go because we want to control our lives, but there's something even scarier. We feel that we are letting go and yielding to a higher power, a being which exceeds our ability to comprehend it, which has, as it were, more dimensions than we can perceive. Indeed, it was for this reason that, in Surprise by Joy, Lewis said that as he got closer and closer to God, he began to grow afraid when he realized that God might be a person, not just a spirit. Quote, "People who are naturally religious find difficulty in understanding the horror of such a revelation. Remember, I had always wanted, above all things, not to be interfered with. I had wanted, mad wish, to call my soul my own." End quote. What is such terror, or horror, then? And why does it begin to emerge when we approach the spiritual world? To understand this, I think we have to turn back once again to one of Lewis's medieval guides, Dante, who gives us a similar image of holiness mingled with awe and even horror. The scene comes toward the end of Purgatorio, where it seems to a first-time reader that the journey has almost come to a conclusion. Even Dante's guide, Virgil, seems to think it's just about over. He says to Dante at the end of Purgatorio 27, "You may sit down or move among these until the fair eyes come rejoicing," end quote. At any moment, then, the reunion between lover and beloved will take place. One scholar sums it up this way, quote, "After several dramatic days of testing travel through hell and purgatory, which taxed him intellectually, emotionally, and spiritually, Dante's character, reassured by an enchanting dream, wakes for the first time on his journey in a peaceful and relaxed manner. He soon finds himself on the edges of a perfect garden. The pilgrim's nearly home. The wayfarer seems at last to have reached a deserved haven of calm and repose, and he is about to be rewarded for his efforts. And yet, the canti which follow most certainly do not depict a moment of calm and harmony, nor do they describe a charming reunion between long-separated lovers. Beatrice is angry, unrelentingly reproachful, and vigorously incisive. The pilgrim, in his turn, is ashamed, confused, and almost at a loss for words." In other words, something is about to spin terribly out of control. Dante doesn't enjoy a romantic reunion in a field with long grasses. Rather, a supernatural apocalyptic procession alights within the garden. Here's how Dante himself puts it, quote, "And behold, a shining suddenly ran through the great forest on all sides, such that it made me wonder if it were lightning. But since lightning, as soon as it comes, ceases, and this lasting shone brighter and brighter, and my thought, I said, what thing is this?" The pilgrim has difficulty even identifying the nature of the eerie event. The images he uses to describe it become more and more unnatural as the canto proceeds. A sweet melody comes coursing through the luminous air, as if the sound and the color were the same. The company flames more brightly than the moon at midnight, and as they advance, the air is transformed into a colored substance, as if they're so steeped in heavenly light that they burn color into the air as they pass through it. The poet turns to this thin aesthetic blending of images to gesture at what he saw, as if wildly gesticulating at something well beyond language. He sees sounds and hears sights. The world of nature begins to melt down in the heat of this extraordinary event. It's this perception of the awful majesty of God which has become rather foreign to the modern world. In contrast, the sense of the awful sacred presence of God was alive in the medieval world, particularly within the visionaries and commentators who took John's Apocalypse as their inspiration, that book which uses famously difficult and symbolic language about the lady, the beast, the righteous martyrs, seals, and bowls of judgment. In addition to providing the secret history of the world, medieval readers believed that the apocalypse, in all of its strange and enigmatic language, briefly pulled back the veil of reality to let us see the awful truth of the majesty of God. And it's this apocalyptic vision of things which inspires Dante here. What Dante sees and indeed feels in these last canti is steeped in the imagery of the book of Revelation and Isaiah and Ezekiel. For instance, Dante is ordered, like John, to write down what he sees, although he barely understands what it means. He dutifully records that the long parade is led first by 24 elders carrying lilies, four beasts with brightly colored wings, a chariot pulled by the griffin carrying Beatrice. On one side of the chariot is a group of three female figures dressed in red, green, and white. On the other side, a group of four ladies dancing in purple. Then come two old men, a doctor, and one carrying a sword. The old men are followed by four humbly dressed men who are in turn followed by a sleepwalker. Canto 30 then tells us that 100 angels will join the procession for a total of precisely 144 members in this sacred parade. But the pilgrim barely registers any of this. He's too stunned by the glory of the event. At two points, he turns to Virgil for help and understanding. Quote, "Full of wonder, I turned to my good Virgil, and he answered with a look no less charged with amazement." Garrulous, avuncular Virgil, always full of calm and beneficent counsel, just shakes his head. He too is completely at a loss to explain this event. The power of this passage can be captured in a single word. It's a vision of the numinous, a term coined by another author from Lewis's list, Rudolf Otto. At the beginning of the 20th century, this German theologian wrote a famous book called The Idea of the Holy, in which he pointed out that modern man has rather lost a sense of what the holy is. The book deeply influenced both Lewis and Tolkien, and Lewis probably read it multiple times throughout his life. Otto's chief argument was that we moderns tend to think of holiness as being very good and religious. In reality, Otto claims, all the ancient languages and primitive religions treat holiness as that irrational overplus of meaning that extends beyond goodness. Holiness is a frightening and terrifying power that goes far beyond simple goodness. Rudolf Otto used the term numinous to get at what he was talking about. Otto says, quote, "There is no religion in which the numinous does not live as the real innermost core, and without it, no religion would be worthy of the name," end quote. For Otto, the numinous is that reality whose majesty is so far beyond our ordinary experience that it's difficult for us to classify it simply as good or bad. It is at once both alluring and dangerous, beautiful and terrifying. To describe the numinous more accurately, Rudolf Otto said that it had five characteristics. First, it is a mysterium, that is literally a mystery or a secret, but not in the way we ordinarily use that word. A mystery novel leaves you puzzled like a detective story until you figure out the missing piece. But the true mystery never loses its question-provoking nature even when you learn about it. It inspires a response of stupor, quote, "blank wonder and astonishment that strikes us dumb, amazement absolute," end quote. The numinous can also be said to be tremendum, that is, a mystery that causes fear, trembling, religious dread, awe. It's uncanny. It causes you to shudder, like the weird sisters in Macbeth do, because it seems on a different plane of being. But unlike the weird sisters, that which is supremely numinous possesses dread majesty, an overpowering unapproachability. At the same time, Otto says that it has an urgent energy, as if it is on the verge of pouring forth and ever going out. Otto says that the mystics refer to this when they write about the consuming fire of God, whose burning strength the mystic can hardly bear, but begs that the heat that has scorched him may be mitigated, lest he be himself destroyed by it, end quote. But at the same time, Otto says, it's a mysterium affascinans. It may appear to the mind an object of horror and dread, but at the same time, it's no less something that allures with a potent charm. And the creature who trembles before it, utterly cowed and cast down, has always at the same time the impulse to turn to it, may even to make it somehow his own. The mystery is for him not merely something to be wondered at, but something that enters into him, end quote. But all of these properties exist simultaneously in the numinous. It's frightening. imposing, powerful, and wondrous. It feels that it's rushing out while at the same time drawing you in. It dwells on a different plane of reality, and for this reason, it inspires dread in the creature who comes into contact with it. This is exactly what we find in the Old Testament when Isaiah is given a vision of God, seated enthroned in his holiness. The experience described in Isaiah 6 shook Isaiah to the core. Once you're aware of this concept, you can find it everywhere in Lewis's writings, just as in Dante's apocalyptic scene from the end of the Purgatorio. For instance, in The Problem of Pain, Lewis describes a special type of spiritual dread. Quote, "Suppose you were told there was a tiger in the next room. You would know that you were in danger, and you would probably feel fear. But if you were told there was a ghost in the next room and believed it, you would feel indeed what is often called fear, but of a different kind. It would not be based on the knowledge of danger, for no one is primarily afraid of what a ghost may do to him, but of the mere fact that it's a ghost. It's uncanny rather than dangerous, and the special kind of fear it excites may be called dread. With the uncanny, one has reached the fringes of the numinous. Now, suppose that you were told simply, there's a mighty spirit in the room, and believed it. Your feelings would then be even less like the mere fear of danger, but the disturbance would be profound. You would feel wonder and a certain shrinking, a sense of inadequacy to cope with such a visitant, and of prostration before it, an emotion which might be expressed in Shakespeare's words, under it my genius is rebuked. This feeling may be described as awe, and the object which excites it is the numinous. As we have seen, the numinous is that sense of the holy, that is, the mysterious, the frightening, and the uncanny. And the exact same concept reappears in fictional form in his Perelandra of 1944, published 4 years after The Problem of Pain. Lewis described the strange frisson that the narrator got from accidentally coming into the presence of a superterrestrial creature, a kind of bodiless angelic being that speaks not through moving air, but intellectually. The narrator writes that the creature seemed to have, quote, reference to some horizontal, to some whole system of directions based outside the earth. Its mere presence imposed that alien system on me and abolished the terrestrial horizon, end quote. The narrator goes on, I had no doubt at all that I was seeing an Eldil, and little doubt that I was seeing the Archon of Mars, the Oyarsa of Malacandra. And now that the thing had happened, I was no longer in a condition of abject panic. My sensations were, it is true, in some ways very unpleasant. The fact that it was quite obviously not organic, the knowledge that the intelligence was somehow located in this homogeneous cylinder of light, but not related to it as our consciousness is related to our brains and nerves, was profoundly disturbing. It would not fit into our categories. The response which we ordinarily make to a living creature and that which we make to an inanimate object were both equally inappropriate. My fear was now of another kind. I felt sure that the creature was what we call good, but I wasn't sure whether I liked goodness so much as I had supposed. This is a very terrible experience. As long as what you are afraid of is something evil, you may still hope that the good may come to your rescue. But suppose you struggle through the good and find that it is dreadful. Here, at last, was a bit of that world beyond the world which I had always supposed that I loved and desired, breaking through and appearing to my senses. And I didn't like it. I wanted to go away. I wanted every possible distance, gulf, curtain, blanket, and barrier to be placed between me and it. But I did not fall quite into the gulf. Oddly enough, my very sense of helplessness saved me and steadied me, for now I was quite obviously drawn in. You can see here in this extraordinary passage all of the themes we have discussed. The sense of the distance beyond our world and the world beyond, the ontological terror it produces, as well as the shrinking feeling experienced in the merely mortal creature, its desire to hide. We can also hear echoes of Lewis's own struggles with God, his fear of letting this supernatural power take over his life, but at the same time, a deep desire to let his soul be open. Although Lewis never backed off from this extraordinary call to a similarly radical kind of surrender, what MacDonald had called the demand of obedience, he also thought that such a level of self-gift was not something we could well achieve on our own. Quote, "I am not in despair," he said in his essay, Slip of the Tongue, after confessing to loving creaturely goods with too much zeal. And then he continues, quote, "At this point, I become what some would call very evangelical. I do not think any efforts of my own will or can end once and for all this craving for limited liabilities, this fatal reservation. Only God can," end quote. And it is this extraordinary effort by God as the judge of the secret things of the heart, which I believe can be found in the judgment scene Until We Have Faces, and its medieval inspiration, the judgment scene from Dante's Purgatorio. We'll talk just a little bit more about the scene from Dante first. When Dante the pilgrim first comes into the presence of Beatrice, he experiences again that trembling which he felt as a young man and describes so vividly in Vita Nuova. Quote, "And in my spirit, which for so long a time had not been overcome with awe that used to make me tremble in her presence, even though I could not see her with my eyes, through the hidden force that came from her, I felt the overwhelming power of that ancient love." End quote. Dante is, once again, the overwhelmed lover, shaken by the glory of Beatrice's beauty. But Beatrice is not interested in merely displaying her glory, but rather in getting the pilgrim to repent. When the disoriented pilgrim turns for the last time to Virgil to discover that his faithful guide and friend is not there, Beatrice says, "Do not weep. Do not weep yet. There is another sword to make you weep," end quote. She then begins to upbraid him, quote, "How did you dare approach the mountain? Do you not know that here man lives in joy?" End quote. Beatrice shames Dante in front of a huge crowd, which makes the experience all the more painful. In fact, she's so harsh that the pilgrim passes out, overwhelmed by the surprise of this verbally abusive encounter. It's fascinating, then, that Dante characterizes this whole numinous incident, in which everything feels like it's spinning out of control, as a moment of repentance. Moments before, Dante was looking at an ideal landscape, taking it in with somewhat passive enjoyment, like a man looking out over the Bay of Naples on a cool summer evening. But now, in this moment of confession, Dante is being violently addressed by name. His safely objective enjoyment has become a painfully subjective IU encounter. He can't just sit on the back row and listen. He's being forcefully and directly addressed. But Beatrice takes all of this one step further. She accuses the pilgrim of infidelity. Beatrice unabashedly says to Dante, quote, "Never did art or nature set before you beauty as great as in the lovely members that enclosed me," end quote. She then says her fault was that he was unfaithful to her beauty, quote, "And if that highest beauty failed you in my death, what mortal thing should then have drawn you to desire it? Indeed, at the very first arrow of deceitful things, you should have risen up and followed me, who was no longer of them," end quote. The poet's getting at a deep point. If it really was the case that Dante had encountered supernatural beauty, how was it possible that he could have settled for anything less? Surely any other attractive thing ought to have struck him as a pale shadow after he had a real experience of beauty in its fullness. Beatrice exposes, as it were, the pilgrim's primal act of infidelity. That is, he has sinned against the memory of beauty. Dante falsified his own experience, feigning to himself that any beauty after could remotely compare. And it is at this point that Beatrice forcefully elicits a confession from the confused pilgrim. She demands that he admit that he has been unfaithful to her, unfaithful to love, unfaithful to beauty. To Beatrice's aggressive questions, the pilgrim can barely whisper his answer about why he fell. Quote, "After heaving a bitter sigh, I hardly had the voice to give the answer my lips were laboring to shape. In tears I said, things set in front of me with their false delights turned back my steps the moment that your countenance was hidden." In a moment of complete vulnerability and spiritual nudity, Dante has to let his soul be radically known, to let all of its secrets be viewed by all. He has to confess in front of a huge crowd his innermost failing. From this vantage, all the, quote, false images of good, end quote, don't just seem misdirected, they seem paltry, pathetic, reprehensible, detestable, and small. By confessing his primal act of infidelity against Beatrice, he's forced to return to the root of his soul, an idea that Dante hints at in one of the most powerful passages of this scene. Quote, with less resistance is the sturdy oak torn from the earth than was my chin nudged up by her command, and my vision blurred. The nettle of remorse so stung me then that whatever else had lured me most to loving had now become for me most hateful, end quote. And yet, at the same time that Dante endures this excruciatingly personal confession being made to uproot sin from the core of his being, he also has returned to the root of mankind in the garden, having returned to the garden on behalf of humanity, and re-entered the state of original justice. Dante has become a kind of new Adam, and thus he must also confess and unchoose, as it were, mankind's original act of infidelity, the act in which man presumed that all things lay within his reach, merely because his powers were ideally balanced. The medieval poet then creates a dreamlike sequence of canti, full of obscurity and mystery, in which his poetic epic is invaded by lyric and apocalyptic literary elements. He's overwhelmed, shaken, and broken up, so that he can, standing in for humanity, unchoose man's original act of presumption by acknowledging the infinite depths of God. He has had his humanity restored. He has been returned to creation. Now he must have a vision of his creaturehood impressed upon him. Dante has returned to the garden as a second Adam to undo the original father's mistake. I've already discussed how well Lewis knew Dante's poetry, and so it should not come as a great surprise to find echoes, or at least the same sentiment, reappearing in the judgment of Orwell at the end of Till We Have Faces. As readers of Till We Have Faces will know, Orwell is in some sense the perfect figure of that Augustinian or Dantean tendency to live our lives in external things, to keep ourselves busy with projects and ambitions so as never to have to face our own vacuous interior. Orwell wears a veil the entirety of her life, and it functions as a kind of symbol of one who does not want to let her inner self be known, who refuses to unveil herself even to her own eyes. Within the whole context of secrecy and fear, the final judgment scene is powerful, almost frighteningly intimate. Like Beatrice forces Dante to utter his confession, Orwell is also forced to be known, to be open, to be vulnerable, and to be exposed. Orwell has to let the gods do the saving. In particular, toward the end of the book, Orwell begins to recognize that her soul is as cramped and disfigured as her aged body, and she determines to try to let go of her hate and resentment, to practice philosophy as her childhood Greek tutor had taught her. But alas, her human efforts to bring about her inner purity fail. As she says, quote, I would set out boldly each morning to be just and calm and wise in all my thoughts and acts. But before they had finished addressing me, I would find that I was back in some old rage, resentment, gnawing fantasy, or sullen bitterness. I could not hold out half an hour, end quote. It's shortly after this that Orwell enjoys a dream, which Lewis is careful to characterize in a medieval fashion as one of those true dreams, which the medieval world thought had deeper significance. It's the same sort of dream Lewis tried to write up in his Great Divorce. In this dream, Orwell has to walk across a desert with a scroll in her hand. To her shame and embarrassment, she soon realizes that a great assembly has gathered to listen to her read this scroll, which turns out to be a great subconscious complaint against the gods. When she realizes what she's doing almost involuntarily, Orwell feels embarrassed to be exposing what she had thought was a private grudge, now in front of this massive seated assembly. But nevertheless, as if under some kind of spell, she's forced to go on reading in front of this immense assembly of everyone she had ever loved. Quote, it was a great assembly, all staring upon me, and I uplifted on my perch above their heads. Never in peace or war have I seen so vast a concourse. There were 10,000 of them, all silent, every face watching me, end quote. When she comes to the end of her complaint, though, She's further humiliated. Odawall can no longer hide from anything, the narrator continues. Uncover her, said the judge. Hands came from behind me and tore off my veil. After it, every rag I had on, the old crone with her ugly face stood naked before those countless gazers. No thread to cover me, nothing in my hands, only my book. What's fascinating about this whole shocking scene is that Odawall, in this moment of vulnerability and exposure, has to come to terms with what she is actually angry at. She admits to have had an encounter with divinity, and she also admits to having made up excuses her whole life not to have paid attention to that encounter with the gods. And finally, she must admit that what makes her the most angry is that the gods are winsome on account of their fearful beauty. If they were ugly, then it would be easier to hate them. It would be easier to refuse to let go of the small and inferior things we cling to so fiercely. Or, as Odawall puts it, do you think we mortals will find you gods easier to bear if you're beautiful? I tell you that that's true. If that's true, we'll find you 1,000 times worse, for then you'll lure and entice. You'll leave us nothing, nothing that's worth our keeping or your taking. Those we love best, whoever's most worth loving, those are the very ones you'll pick out. It would be far better for us if you were foul and ravening. We'd rather you drank their blood than stole their hearts. We'd rather they were ours and dead than yours and made immortal. Why? What should I care for some horrible new happiness which I hadn't given her, which separated her from me? Did you ever remember whose the girl was? She was mine, mine. End quote. Odawall here references her beloved sister Psyche, who had to be sacrificed to the gods. But, as it turned out, the god to whom she was offered was not only beautiful, but in love with Psyche. When she finishes her angry tirade, then, Odawall's mentor explains to her that the gods wait until we have formulated our words, the secret words of our hearts, and then let our speech, most perfect now, come out, our speech of complaint, and emerge from our very soul. But tragically, our very complaint becomes our own condemnation, because it is an exposure of our selfish love. The judgment scene then concludes in a fascinating way. Soon after, she has been forced to look upon the ugliness of her own desire, which she had thought noble throughout the entirety of her life. Odawall then is allowed to see a vision. She sees that her sister, Psyche, even while loving the divine, had never lost love for her. And Odawall also now sees how, unbeknownst to her, her sister had endured trials of love precisely for her sake. The book concludes in a reunion between the two sisters. And when Odawall sees now Psyche in her full glory, she falls at her feet in tears and she confesses, "O Psyche, O goddess, never again will I call you mine, but all there is of me shall be yours. Alas, you know now what it's worth. I never wished you well, never had one selfless thought of you. I was a craver." End quote. But Psyche, repeating words from Lewis's favorite poet, George Herbert, says, "You must stand up. Did I not tell you that a day was coming when you and I would meet in my house and no cloud between us?" The narrator concludes, "Joy silenced me." In this powerful scene, Lewis shows that deep confession, that encounter with divinity in all of its purity and loveliness and mercy and even fearfulness, can wash away even our fierce clinging to the small loves of this world, our twisted possessiveness, and can make us clean.